This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the year-over-year change in the U.S. Consumer Price Index exceed 2.4% in March of 2025? At Interactive Brokers, the yes forecast contract was recently priced at 62% and the no was at 36%. IBKR Forecast Trader lets you use exchange-listed forecast contracts to trade your opinion on yes or no questions on future events like climate change, the economy, politics. You choose yes or no. And if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Interactive Brokers forecast contracts are commission-free, and you earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon, and you'll get $3 USD when you start trading forecast contracts. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Check out the data, spot the trends, and make your prediction. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. Because the best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Economics, confidence waning. The market's doing a loop-de-loop with every comment out of Washington. We're going to take a big cleansing breath today. We have some insights from our Buddhist friends, right straight back from me being in India. And we have a great guest, Wes Gray from Alpha Architect. All this and much more on episode number 913 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, it's Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm pretty pumped for our show today because we have a great guest coming on, and we had him on about a year ago, Wes Gray, and I thought he was incredibly smart. We'll talk about that in a bit. Just had a great milestone. Spent the weekend celebrating my birthday, and it has a zero at the last number, so those are always big. Those are always those moments in time. I remember a few of these when I went back and I looked at, some of the zeros in the past. And they're always like, oh, only that much more is left. Kind of gets to you. The good news is it's not 1920s or 30s anymore where people are, an average age of 65 and they knock off. No, it's much different. In the 90s, people are living through and there's a lot more time for me left. Listen, there's a lot more shows to do, a lot more education, a lot more insights that we're going to get from the guests over the next 30 years. So stick around. Don't go anywhere at all because we are going to be here. There's no giving up at this point. I want to talk about the economy a little bit and talk about some of the things that we're seeing. There's a combination, a confluence, I guess, of things that are happening right now. We have this hysteria that is being prompted by every move that happens out of Washington right now. And the concern that we are going to end up in a recession because what we saw was, number one, a pull forward effect, probably in the fourth quarter of last year, a little bit earlier. And then a slowdown. And then on top of that, a slowdown because of the uncertainty that is being brought to us, a la the tariffs and the various job cuts, the deficit reduction acts that are being planned, and the lack of the understanding of whether or not the Fed is going to play ball. Even though the Fed did have a nice discussion talking about how they're pretty much, still looking like there could be two cuts by the end of the year. That's what they're projecting still, to try to breathe a little life back into these markets and take them off the bottoms, because we did see that the S&P 500, the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ, the Dow had a pretty ugly start to the year and really exacerbated over the last 4 weeks or so, where the big mega cap names, the super dupers, the Mag 7 that they're now, I think, calling the Lag 7. That's the new name, right? The laggards And then we saw that whether it was Facebook or Google or clearly Tesla and the names that you know and love so much really took a beating. And that because of their weighting in the market cap weighted S&P 500, NASDAQ, really hurt things. Now, the small cap's totally different animal. That is being punished due to the fact that there's a thought that there's going to be the potential for a recession. And that's really something. And the recession odds have gone up dramatically almost daily. And you're hearing news about it and commentary from a lot of people. Now, one of the things we saw that I thought was pretty disturbing was the consumer confidence recently. And the University of Michigan we saw that came out saw a significant drop, right? The number was 57.9. Consensus was at 65. Last month was 64. This is a big number. We're talking about a drop from 110 somewhere right before, I guess, COVID, and a continual drop down of this index. This marked the third consecutive decline on a monthly basis in consumer sentiment. Now, a year ago, you look backwards at where were we, right? Okay, well, how bad is it? Well, a year ago, it was at 79. We're talking about, 22 points differential. The current economic conditions decreased from 65 to 63, I'm rounding these numbers, down from about 82 a year ago. In other words, what people are thinking their current condition is right now at this moment, not looking forward, not looking backward. Where am I? People are not happy. People are not happy. The expectation numbers saw even the worst drop. That's the, okay, well, what do we think is going to happen within about, a year or so? Well, it dropped from 64 to 54. A year ago was 77. So not only are people concerned about where they are right now, but they're looking at the future and saying, things aren't so good. I don't think they're getting better. In fact, I think they're going to be worse. On top of that, there's an inflation expectation in there, and that was big. It climbed from 4.3% to 4.9% for the year ahead inflation expectation, the highest level since November 2022. The idea that tariffs are not going to increase prices, consumers are having none of that crap. They realize that if these tariffs and how these tariffs go on are going to cause a significant increase in prices. And that's what they're looking at. This is the largest long-run inflation expectation increase since 1993 inside this data. So the decline in sentiment is throughout a variety of groups, whether it's socioeconomic, wealth-related, political affiliations, geographic, all of this uncertainty and all of this concern about the future is really causing a problem. That is showing itself. It's revealing itself and manifesting inside of what people are doing with their money. That's what we talk about here, right? So it's all about this. Forget about the politics. Forget about whether you believe this, hope this, whatever. We're talking about what is really happening right here and now. That's all we care about at the moment and in the future. At the moment right now, people are concerned. Money's fleeing the U.S. Where's it going? Well, it's going to emerging markets, which are doing well. Europe, Germany hit an all-time high. The DAX hit an all-time high recently. We're seeing China up 24% this year on China. We're seeing bonds do very well. Real estate starting to pick up a little bit also as yields are coming down. Gold, all-time high. All these things are just saying one thing. Money wants to go somewhere. It does not necessarily want to be in the U.S. right now. So with that, if you've been following along and you've been playing the game of what we call diversification, the flower garden I always talk about and how we want to have different things in bloom at any given time of the year. If you were undiversified last year and the year before that, hey, that was great. If you had U.S. stocks primarily and specifically large caps, great. If, in fact, you had all that this year, not so good. This year, the reason why things are going well for certain people and portfolios is because they have an allocation towards emerging markets and Europe and developed, international. They have a position in alternatives that are doing well, maybe even some commodities, hard metals. And they're not just solely in U.S. Now, you would say, well, okay, that's great. Now, historically, I will tell you, that's worked. It's only been the last few years that it hasn't, and spotty times throughout history. Something to think about. Now, with all this going on, I started thinking about people's anxiety level, you know, your level of I can't sleep at night kind of thing, hoping you wake up in the morning and things look better. Because 2025 has been anything but steady for U.S.-focused investors, right? With the heightened volatility, the declining confidence we just talked about, markets swinging unpredictably. So we're going to take a moment and do a cleansing breath in and out. Do that a few times as I'm talking to you here. Because this period of turbulence presents an opportunity to pause, I think, and reflect, to evaluate and look at the broader landscape. And notably, while the U.S. stocks are in a corrective phase, yes, a corrective phase, I'm trying to talk very calmly as you're breathing, because I want this to be an experience where we could really try to get a little bit of calm here. Because most of the companies that were most owned, most cherished, we know they're having problems. So it's an opportune time right now, no matter how you're invested, to take this deep calming breath and draw wisdom, because I was thinking about this a lot as I just got back from India, from some sagely techniques. And so for the moment, we're going to look through the lens of two complementary Buddhist principles as we try to put that into play with the discussion of stock market and volatility. We're going to focus on two things. We're going to focus on equanimity and right effort. Equanimity and right effort, two Buddhist teachings. Now, equanimity, which is said in the language, is upekkha. Upekkha. U-P-E-K-K-H-A. Yes, there's two K's next to each other. Now, what that does is it teaches us to maintain a balance and a steady mind. Because we want to recognize that the markets have highs, the markets have lows, and that's temporary. And it's cyclical in nature. We know that. Trees don't grow to the sky. We know that. We know that we shouldn't just necessarily be focused in on the upside only and just chasing that, because when the downside comes, it can hurt. Now, by observing these fluctuations with mindfulness, detachment, that's hard. What we can do as investors is try to avoid the emotional decision-making fear-greed cycle that goes on. Instead, what we can do is we can engage with clarity, with wisdom, acknowledging that, well, this too shall pass. This is just a temporary moment in the cycle, a cycle that we know that could be long or short, could be high or low, wide or thin. It could be almost non-existent for some and very pronounced for others. At the same time, the other principle I want to talk about, and then we can bring them together, is right effort, or samavayama. And what that does, it reminds us to take thoughtful and purposeful actions to adapt to changing circumstances. Kind of like what a sailor does, right? They're sailing out there and they adjust their sails. They're going to navigate in the various ocean conditions, the shifting winds. And as an investor, you too could do the same thing. You could assess your strategy. You could make measured adjustments over time. Stay aligned with where the wind is blowing. And more importantly, what your final destination is. Or said another way, your long-term goals. Because adapting to change is not a weakness. It's actually, the way I see it, it's a sign of strength and resilience. Now, when we put these together, these two principles, right? Equanimity and right effort. It can provide something really genuinely enlightening for you in terms of investing. It provides a framework, this overarching way of looking at things and approaching market uncertainty with calmness, flexibility, adaptability, because that's the most important part, which allows us to respond wisely, calmly, rather than impulsively. Because all these things that are happening, we're trying to understand. All these external events, we're trying to filter and sieve through and understand as things are hitting us in the face on a daily basis at 1,000 miles an hour. But if we think about equanimity, right? Equanimity, balance, steady mind, understanding that, yeah, things have highs and lows, right effort, which is the thoughtful and purposeful actions and ability to adapt to changing conditions. What this does is reminds us to stay grounded, make intentional course corrections, and maintain a focus on the bigger picture. Two, I thought, really great lessons that I could bring together from some of my research. I'm not Buddhist. Some of the things I learned when I was in India recently. And I thought it was really very good timing for this in our discussion today. I'm going to get to our guest in a moment. But I did want to talk about Interactive Brokers once again. And there's some things that maybe as an investor you didn't know, but one of the things that you should know is that at Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for the markets to open. You know, that 9:30 bell that goes off? Because Interactive Brokers has around-the-clock trading. And you could trade over 10,000 U.S.-listed stocks and ETFs, U.S. equity index futures and options and U.S. Treasury bonds and more around the clock. That's cool. IBKR's overnight trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and economic events whenever they happen. Things happen when we're, you know, late at night when the other markets are open. So that's important. You can capture more market opportunities and trade on your timetable whenever it's convenient for you. Enjoy bond trading with no markups, no built-in spreads, and low transparent commissions. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. So let's talk about our guest for a second. Before he comes on, I want to do a little something here. Give him his street cred, because Wes Gray, he's a founder of Alpha Architect. And after serving as a captain in the United States Marine Corps, he earned his MBA and his PhD, that's why he's Dr. Gray, in finance from the University of Chicago, where he studied under Nobel Prize winner Eugene Fama. I've studied his work. That's something very significant. This is a smart guy we're going to talk to today. Next, he took on an academic job in his wife's hometown in Philly and worked as a finance professor at Drexel University. His interest in bridging the research gap between academia and industry led him to found Alpha Architect, which is an asset management firm dedicated to impacting and empowering investors through education. He's a contributor to multiple industry publications, regularly speaks to professional investors groups across the country. He's published a lot of academic papers and 4 books. The latest one is Quantitative Momentum by Wiley in 2016. I'm very excited about this. So let's get right to Wes Gray. Wes, how are you? It's been a while.
Yeah, doing great. Honored to be here.
You're down in PR, Puerto Rico. The lights are on?
The lights are on and the taxes are low, so I'm happy.
What else can you ask for, right?
Exactly.
I wanted to start with a little bit backtracking to get a little bit more base about who you are, your personal journey. And I was, you know, just rattling off all your street cred and all that. And I thought I'd ask you to start and to get this conversation going. What inspired you to make the transition from academia to, you know, founding Alpha Architect?
So going way back, I always kind of knew, even as a kid, like I wanted to do business, like to do my own thing. Like I was just been kind of independent. Mm-hmm. Right. And And I also just like adventure and more intense things. And to be frank, you know, being a professor is a great life. It's probably one of the most cheeseball jobs you can, you know, possibly achieve, especially in a finance department where you get paid a lot of money. You know, you're just paid to basically do research. It's awesome, right? Like if you're in different departments, it can be a lot different deal, but usually business school gigs, especially around finance professorships. I mean, it's a dream job by any standard. But you know, I just like to do more practical real world stuff. Mm-hmm. And I like doing academic things. So I'd always kind of been sniffing around and I always hoped and dreamed that I could somehow transition and pivot into the real world. It just went on fast track and I got lucky because way back in the day, you know, going back 15, 16 years ago, I used to write a blog, you know, before blogs were even a thing. And, you know, a bunch of rich people read it. So right when I was becoming a professor, I got cold called by a billionaire who was looking to transition ownership of their own capital because it was after 08. They got smoked. They're like, we're firing everybody. I don't trust anybody. I read this stupid blog from this PhD guy. Maybe I can pitch him. And it was perfect because, like, I was behind the scenes very interested in finding somehow to, like, start a business. This family, this dude was like very interested in working with someone who's not from the business. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a match made in heaven.
That's great.
Yeah. So it was just, you know, good timing to meet a billionaire. And he happened to find like an academic who wanted to actually transition at some point. So, you know, just good luck. Good timing.
That's awesome. So really what you are, if you think about it, you're a, you know, because I think you and I have something in common on this thing. Cause I've been thinking about this recently, actually. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, what's my business? What have I been doing? How did I get successful and all that? How did I reach the place that I'm at? Right. Social media. You had the same thing.
Yep. 100%.
100%. Right. It's not like, cause you think everybody's like, I'd love to be an influencer. And right. You and I did that. Seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's,
yeah. No, for sure.
I don't even think of it. It just came over me the other day about this.
Big time. If you think about the way the financial service businesses was historically structured, it was all about distribution via old school methods, which is obviously insanely capital intensive. It's tons of economic moat. How would you ever do that? And like the internet and social media basically democratized the world where, like, if you have good ideas, you like to share information, you like to write, you like to engage, you know, anyone on the internet can talk to you. So you can basically replicate distribution in some sense, much more scalably. And that's what's opened up the doors on all kinds of business operators and financial services.
I bet though, that if I was to ask you about something that when you first started writing your blog, it was more of like your desire to have a cathartic experience of taking what you have and getting it out there, maybe just documenting it. Right. It was not, so, well, clearly back then it wasn't social, you know, influencing, or it wasn't, I'll write this stuff for business. That's the difference what a lot of people do today. They're like, I want to do that so I can get business.
I agree. You have to do it, as you know, authentic.
Yes.
Like humans are very good at bullshit radar, right? Like if you're just going out there, and I can even tell now, like, okay, obviously, like if I go read tweets from iShares, you know, there was some marketing department with like 50 eggheads, like, you know, overpriced, overpaid to like come up with this tweet. But you could smell that a mile away. Like the whole point about social media is they want to interact with a actual real person, not some Harvard MBA, you know, clone, you know, tweet. Like, so I think authenticity is everything. Yeah. And just in business generally, but obviously, as you know, in social media and all that kind of stuff.
Those eggheads, I think I have a name I just thought of, we can call them, you want to call them like pre-bots?
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say anything because, right? I got a lot of MBAs that work on my team, but you know what I mean? Like
no, pre-bots, like
the stereotype.
Yeah, these are the guys, no, the marketing team I'm talking about, the pre-bots. These are the people that were before the automated bots that would be in a room thinking, like, it's like same people that come up for $5 million to change a logo.
Yes.
And this change exactly. of color, you know?
Yeah. No, exactly. Or just, you could just tell, like, when someone has like paid tweets or they have like some marketing department, you could smell that a mile away. And I just don't want to interact with it personally because it's not authentic.
So how did your time in the military, I guess, shape your approach to investing in leadership?
Well, so, you know, I was in the Marines, which is all about, you know, servant leadership. And so the whole idea is like, hey, you're in charge of leading a team. That doesn't mean you're God or you're king. That means you're the servant, right? Like your duty is to help your constituency, your teammates, whatever it is. So, and I just always like that attitude because it seems like kind of like a win-win, like team-oriented way about going on just in life. And that's, you know, that's just how the Marines go about stuff. So, you know, I just like that idea. Like, hey, you know, even if you're the king of the thing or the CEO or whatever the heck it is, like that doesn't mean you're just there to like collect the riches and make people kiss your feet. Like that just means you have more responsibility to work even harder to make sure that your teammates, your clients, whoever, you know, you're trying to help and work with, you know, you just help them out even more so. Cause that's kind of like your job is to like, you know, be a servant leader, not a, you know,
I think you make a stronger dictator. Relationship with your people that would actually follow you rather than cowering and being scared of you. That's why they follow you. In other words, they're seeing the support. They are returning the support. It's a fully rounded and continual sphere of support.
Yeah, exactly. It's just win-wins. Like everyone's winning. Those are usually robust systems and robust architectures where if any situation, just talking like 40,000 foot view, if one side's winning, the other side's losing, those aren't robust.
Yeah.
Something's going to give and it's going to fall apart. But anytime you can just set up relationships in business and life and what have you, where like everyone gives a little bit, takes a little bit, like the win-win, the golden rule, like all the old, you know, old school boring things.
Yeah.
It's actually, those ideas are actually really powerful and simple. Right. So we should just follow them.
Let's talk about investment philosophy. So tell me, I think we got into this a little bit last time, and then I have some other follow-ups on this, but what are the core principles? What are the core philosophies that you utilize at Alpha Architect in terms of investment strategies?
Yep. So it's basically, we have three kind of core beliefs in how we structure our investment strategies. At this point, you know, we have this huge ETF platform where we run an ETF that does everything under the sun. So those are like just platform strategies, but like Alpha Architect specifically, I mean, essentially it's going to be systematic. Mm-hmm. It's going to be evidence-based and it's going to be transparent, right? So regardless of what we're going to do, you know, we obviously want it to be evidence-based as best as we can interpret and understand and try to seek the intellectual truth. So that's what we mean, like evidence-based, unfortunately. Yeah,
explain that. No, explain like that, because a lot of people talk about that. But what does that exactly mean for those people that have no clue?
Yeah, so what that means is, maybe I should change it from evidence-based, because we've had the same mission and the same core beliefs ever since we started 15 years ago, but I've never adapted those. Mm-hmm. But obviously the marketplace has. So our original mission as a firm is we empower investors through education. That's still our why mission as a firm at Alpha Architect. And our core principles has always been systematic, evidence-based, transparent, and we have another one called win-wins. But evidence-based, is, again, I should relabel this like intellectual truth. It just means that we're going to look at the collective evidence of what everyone says, do our own research, try to replicate other studies, and knowing full well that we're never going to be perfect. But like, what do we think is genuine truth in the marketplace? And, you know, usually our standard is, and would I put my own money in this thing? That to us means evidence-based. Now, the problem with evidence-based as a term is it become bastardized because now everybody that runs a back test says it's evidence-based.
Right.
But that's different. Right. Evidence-based, because you ran your own custom back test over a certain period under certain conditions that gives you the answer you want to say. That's not intellectual truth. That's just called, you know, fitting the data to the narrative. That's marketing. And so that's what happened with evidence-based, is like, you know, it got ruined as a term. So I should probably change that to like intellectual truth or whatever. But that's what I mean by that. Like, what is true in the marketplace as best as we can understand it, even if it may be good or bad for us from like a business perspective, like who cares? Let's just try to do what we think makes the most sense.
Yeah.
What would we want to put our money into?
It's funny because a lot of those things that you talk about, like evidence-based, and that was a term used for a while. It still is, but I'm saying that that was like all of a sudden a hotspot, right? I remember back in the day of, you know, when Sharp and the gang, Benson, Breebauer, Bebauer and Hood, and they were all doing this whole, and Markowitz, you know, they're doing the whole mean variance optimized portfolios with Fish and Frontiers and all that. And there was this paper that came out, and the discussion was about the you know, the 90% number. It was like 87 sometimes. It was 90% yeah. of a variability. Remember that whole paper? Remember that? That was a big yep. one, right? That was the, this paper, yeah, yeah. for those of you who don't know, this was like the whole thing that was creating the rationale between why do you want to diversify? What is the point? The problem is, just like you said before, it got bastardized, right? Because all of a sudden, everybody's like, 90% means this. No, 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 no. It was 90% of the variability was this and that. It was a whole different discussion. It was more of a, I would say, a mathematical, statistical methodology that you could look at that. But all the marketing guys caught on it and said, 90% is 90% of your returns is because of diversification, which was like, no, that's not right. But it caught on.
Exactly. There's a lot of that. There's actually a really cool paper. I can't remember what it's called. Victor de McGill. We blogged about it probably 10 years ago. But he has a really funny paper where it's kind of related to this, where there's all these like fancy optimization, PhD, geek out ways to quote unquote build portfolios. And he said, well, that's kind of interesting. Well, let's just run a horse race against all these fancy like PhD math tools and equal weight in the context of equity allocation. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, guess what? Equal weight is one of the best strategies you could do because it, one thing, it guarantees basic diversification because you can't screw that up too bad because if you're equal weight, you know you're getting some level of like,
sure,
you know, different eggs in your basket. Whereas the problem with like fancy models and optimization and like way overthinking things is that the model will sometimes tell you things that just don't make any sense because they're unstable. And you know, people just back test till you're blue in the face using some data set they got, but they never considered that. What about out of sample? What about this? What about that? So that one's interesting because it just kind of throws quote unquote evidence-based and all the, you know, the whole history of Nobel Prize winners, some of which are my advisors. Mm-hmm. And it basically says all their stuff is very interesting, but practically it's useless, which is also a funny thing that you see a lot in the real world.
Well, the other thing is sometimes when they do prove something, it does work and then it doesn't. Yeah. You know, how many times is it like, oh yeah, the January effect. No, just, can we please? How about the golden cross, the bear cross? Okay, move along.
Yeah.
You know, once something is known, exactly. it's no longer special. I mean, just
That's true. You can have, that's the other thing that's really difficult is you could find intellectual truth, but then if everyone knows like some way to beat the market or do this system or that system, to your point, it evolves. And now that doesn't work anymore. You know, there's definitely evidence and examples of that happening as well. So it could be evidence-based in the past, but not in the future.
Now, you also, I think, if I recall last time we talked about factor investing, didn't we?
Yeah.
So factor, are you still, is factor investing still, well, first of all, explain it and then we'll go through it.
Yeah. So factor investing can be super geeked out, but the best way I describe it is it's kind of like Moneyball for finance, right? Like if you're probably familiar with the Moneyball thing where it's like, all right, you know, instead of having the scout, like the New York Yankees scout go like, look how buff the baseball player is and how good looking he is to determine if he's going to hit home runs or not. Why don't we just use the actual data on these players and just buy them based on their characteristics, not like how we feel or think about them. That's basically what factor investing has done, right? It said, hey, let's not look at the stocks and know the names. Let's just go look at the underlying characteristics, like what's their size, their value, their momentum, blah, blah, blah. And let's just form portfolios on that because we know that those directionally will point us to higher returns, lower returns, different diversification, you know, higher vol, lower vol, what have you. That's all factor investing is doing. Just using the characteristics of your baseball players, which are stocks, to form portfolios to try to, you know, deliver some sort of outcome you want.
Is that just a fancy name these days for, would you say, quant investing?
Yeah.
I mean, same thing.
Exactly,
filtering, scoring?
Yeah, exactly. That's factor investing. That basically, if you don't overthink it, that's all it is. Like if you go do a screen, like, hey, let's go buy the 10% cheapest PE stocks, like what Ben Graham used to do. Technically, you could say, yeah, that's basically factor investing in some sense.
So it's interesting because one of the first, I don't know why I've been talking about this recently, but it seems that I keep harkening back to many, many years ago when I would spend my weekends in the library reading, and I don't know why this has been coming up so much, but like looking at Value Line, looking at Morningstar, you know, the books, looking at Barron's on the weekend, Investor's Business Daily and all that. But one of the books that really struck me back then, I mean, it was like right in the face, not only because it was gigantic, was Jim O'Shaughnessy's What Works on Wall Street, which is like the factor Bible in a way.
100%. So his book is a great book because it kind of allows practitioners insight into what all like the academics have been saying in the journals for 50 years prior to that. And he has a great way of like doing the narrative version of here's the characteristics, here's how they work, here's what drives return, here's what doesn't work, etc. So it's a great book.
Mm, yeah, love it. All right. So let's talk about some of the future stuff that's going on right now. There's a lot of changes that are happening, have been happening in the investment world, right? You know, from I don't know, a few years ago, no fee trading to, you know, and ETFs taking over a bigger place, which you've been a proponent of and for good reason over the years. A lot of innovations, AI, things like that. But what things maybe in the industry do you see over the next, I don't know, 5-10 years that are really becoming significant that may change things, maybe for advisors and for investors?
Yeah, I mean, I think just because we're in the middle of it and I deal with it all day long, and it's the reason our infrastructure company, grows at 100% per year, is I think this broad movement towards the ETF structure, which is generally more tax efficient, lower fee, and more transparent. It's not for everything. Obviously, it's not a panacea, but getting assets into that structure is an evergreen thing. And we figured out, if you're familiar, like 351 transactions, but like how to tax-free move assets from place A into the ETF wrapper. That is an evergreen business for all assets that have to pay taxes for foreseeable future. I see that growing epic amounts, right? And that's not really like the ETF business, like new ideas or like everyone says, like, do we really need another 1,000 ETFs, because every idea on the sun's been out there. I 100% agree with that. Mm-hmm. However, we might need 1,000 new ETFs because there's a lot of people that would like to operate their assets inside of an ETF to take advantage of all the tax efficiencies, deferral mechanisms, what have you.
Do you worry, though, that if all these things happen and we start creating these individual ETFs vis-a-vis 351s? And by the way, Meb Faber's just launched one.
Yeah, we're behind the scenes, the operators that help facilitate all that. Yep,
that's what I thought. Because we talked about two or three weeks ago on the show. But if everybody creates, all right, so let's give the example. I'm here and I got, let's just use NVIDIA because I guess everybody's favorite example. I have NVIDIA with all sorts of, extraordinary gains on it and a few other things. And I start moving things into, these 351s. I create my own, I create my own 351, right?
Stepping back, like the ETF is literally the world's greatest tax deferral in plain sight, right? It's, you can basically operate, manage your capital, trade, maneuver, adapt, change, tactically allocate, and never have to distribute a capital gain, which is awesome because that means I buy the thing now and in 30 years I get a compound tax free. It's what Warren Buffett, that's how he got so rich, basically. Great tax efficiency and great investing. ETFs basically allowed everybody to get the tax efficiency. You still got to do the investment part. The problem, though, is, well, that's great. But my issue, it just generically, people say this, is like, well, I have my SMA, I got my mutual fund, I got my hedge fund, and I've been really good at investing, but I can't do anything because I got to pay taxes.
Yeah.
So all the 351 thing does is it pulls that wedge where it pulls the frictional cost of transition. And the minute you can pull out the transition, the tax transition cost to get to the more tax efficient vehicle, you have a floodgate of people that say, how do I do this yesterday? Because now the biggest cost of frictional cost of transition has been removed. Sign me up. Right. Because why wouldn't it, water's going to flow like, you know, it has gravity, like water kind of going to flow to its lowest point where it's treated best. So just like capital. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be a big theme, is just people moving into the ETF structure is a big part of the business for sure.
And the reason, just to clarify, while you say this is here to stay is because once you're in, it's a lobster trap. Once you're in, you don't, the whole point is to be in. That's the whole point.
Yeah. The whole point is everybody in a, if it wasn't registered funds, if there weren't so many lawyers, not so much compliance everywhere, if you could just flip a magic switch and say, hey, every individual in the world, you get to be treated like an ETF. Obviously everybody would love that because everyone would do that if you have taxable capital. Obviously the structure, the compliance, the legalities of it all, it's just never going to be that accessible to people. But there's lots of pools of capital out there that are currently in inefficient structures. And if you could figure out a way to move them into the ETF structure without having to eat the tax bill along the way, it's a big theme in the business
Is this a big, I would think that, well, mutual funds, but put that aside for 1 second. I would think that people with SMAs.
Yes.
That SMAs. You had an S&P 500 SMA. And by the way, for people that don't know what that means, you have, basically you go out, you have, I'm just picking a number, $1 million. And you say, I don't want to buy the S&P SPY because I got whatever. I don't want to buy this or that. You may because it's an ETF, but just buy the individual stocks for me. And you have a group out there that will do it for a low cost. And you have established a tremendous amount of money in there. Let's say, $1 million, $2 million, mm-hmm. $5 million, whatever. It doesn't matter. Yep. And now you all of a sudden you went from $1 million you invested. Now you're up to $2 million. You sell anything because you got these huge gains in there. You're done. Take the whole block, move it into an ETF wrapper. Yep. And there's benefit.
Yeah, because now as you highlighted there, the problem is, which is a great problem, is once you start investing, it's usually like a 90-10 situation where, 90% of your gains are going to be generated by 10% of your names. Like your NVIDIA is a good example. Mm-hmm. But at some point you're like, you know what? I don't know if I want NVIDIA at 50 times revenue to be 80% of my portfolio. That seems risky, but I also hate taxes. What do I do? Well, you're not going to do anything because you're not going to want to pay the man his tax bill. So the only thing you could do, and you got to do this, make sure it's all compliant, all that good stuff, is if you could somehow transition that into another structure, like an ETF, for example. Once assets are inside an ETF structure, ETFs have basically a way to, not really a great term, but they could basically cheat in some sense, right? It's called the great ETF tax swindle for a reason. ETFs can essentially rebalance without having to distribute capital gains, where nobody else can do that, right? It's only ETFs that have this capability. But I'm not in charge of writing the laws. I just have the laws written and I just play the game. And so that's the idea. Now I got it in there. Great. I don't like NVIDIA because it's killing my diversification, giving me too much tech risk. Fine. I'll sell it in a what they call like a custom basket, tax free. Take the proceeds and then go buy Exxon or whatever. Right. Which is beautiful. And so you're able to get back to like efficient portfolios, efficient active management, but still maintain like,
right. It's not, let's just say it's not tax free.
No,
it's tax deferred.
Deferred. Yes. Yeah. Which is the best you can do.
Yeah.
You have to die if you want to get your step up.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So there's a big cost. The government's like, hey, you want to step up? Great. Kill yourself. otherwise the best you're going to do is deferral, man.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's just how they
roll. Do you have any concern that with all the shenanigans going on right now, that there could be some, I'm sure that there's something going on that you're talking about that they would possibly look at this to change that law?
I don't think so, because the general intent is you want investors to treat capital correctly. So, because it encourages investment, lowers cost of capital, it's better for capitalism and the broader economy. So if you started doing onerous things that make it more onerous on capital, i.e. via taxes or frictional regulation, all else equal, that's usually bad for society. And so all these things are doing is giving people incentives to invest and they're going to get their taxes when you die at some point. Like, it's not like they're not going to get the tax bill at some point. Cause even like the estate, the step up's limited over, if you're outside the estate rules, it's just the timing of it. So they'll get their pound of flesh, but it's more efficient to not have distortions in capital allocation while people are alive. And there's a lot of economists that I think argue that like death tax is the most efficient because it's actually highly reliable, highly predictable, and it doesn't distort incentives. because, you know, most people that play the business game, it's just fun to like try to get rich, make up a lot of money. And then, okay, fine. When I die, I'm dead anyway. So I'll just pay it to the government or I'll give it away. Right. You know, a lot of people are like, well, I want to give it to my kids. But there's also a big argument that ruins the kids. And it creates like all kinds of imbalance in society. Cause then you got, you know, well, the rich kids, you know, obviously they get to start off on home plate versus the broke kids. That's unfair. So a lot of people argue that like a death tax is actually the most efficient public policy anyways. Yeah. So that, you know, deferral just is basically encoding that formally in the systems. But, you know, I'm not a politician.
Are all ETFs that you do, are they all publicly traded, or are these private?
Nope. So ETFs in the name exchange traded have to be public. And there's no way to do a
private. Have you ever heard, is there such a thing?
There's not such a thing.
That'd be easier.
Yeah. It would be easier, but the key thing is basically like a hedge fund or a mutual fund is already that kind of, right? An ETF is exchange traded, but that's the little secret about ETFs. The way the tax game works is it works through authorized participants and the broker dealers and the whole market making capital markets apparatus. Mm. So necessarily, if you want the tax thing and you want to be able to rebalance and trade through baskets, well, you need to be an exchange traded vehicle because that's how the whole piping was set up. Whereas like the reason mutual funds, the reason, you know, SMAs, the reason hedge funds can't do any of this is because their piping is different, right? They don't have like the mechanisms, how the law's written to be able to take advantage of, the 852B6 and the RIC statute. Yep. So it just is what it is. So you want the tax deal, you got to be an ETF. If you don't want the tax deal, then you could be private and do all kinds of vehicles.
Yep. So Alpha Architect, let's get back to this whole strong emphasis on investor education, because that's a key, a hallmark, a central focus of what you do, right? So if you could teach an investor, just, you know, every investor, just one thing, what would that be?
I mean, I would say identify a process and stick to it. So that's two things, but it's kind of the same thing.
Oh, like, I get that. Right.
You know, it's the main issue I see with people, and it's primarily driven by the financial service industry incentives, is there's a lot of great processes out there, right? People always go crazy on the details and the nuance of it. And Meb, actually, you said he had on here, he has like a great, lots of great studies on this. It doesn't really matter. As long as you have some process reasonably designed, you're probably going to have a decent outcome. Obviously, that process might have ups and downs and all arounds, but in the long game, you know, it's probably going to do pretty good. The problem is people do not stick with their process. And why is that? Well, because what happens is you have a process. We know every process is going to have times when it doesn't work and when it does work. Well, when it doesn't work, there's high financial incentive in the marketplace to pinpoint those situations by salespeople to say, oh, you know, Wes sold you this crazy like value investing idea. That thing sucks. It's down 20% and the market's up 20%. They're a bunch of idiots. You should buy my fund X.
My growth fund
or whatever. Exactly. Right. And so the problem is like people, they hear a process, they understand a process, they internalize a process, and they're like, great, I'm going to stick to this process and tie myself to this thing forever. But then reality hits and they become human again. Oh man, this isn't doing that great. You know, my Merrill Lynch sales guy just pitched me on this amazing thing, the awesomest shiny rock I've ever heard about. And, you know, this thing that this other guy told me is probably BS. I'm going to transition, right? And that's just how our world works. And I don't know how to make it easier for people. But again, just have a process.
I have a way. The top of the show, we talked about it. Two different Buddhist philosophies. I just got back from India, by the way. One of them is called, I'll send this to you, equanimity, upekkha, and right effort. I'm not Buddhist, but I did some research on what I was trying to describe here. Samavayama, which is this whole idea where, and I'll give you the short version, equanimity is this balance of and steady mind, this recognition that markets go high and low and all that. But if you could observe the fluctuations and have this detachment and be mindful of it, you could avoid the emotional. Then you have right effort. Put that on top of this, which is a teaching that we should be thoughtful and have purposeful actions to adapt to changing circumstances. So in other words, not just throw in the towel, but you know, if something changes and it's not working, well, maybe we need to adapt. That doesn't mean to just throw it out, right? But you need to navigate, to adapt, and adapting to the change is not weakness, but it's more of a sign of strength and resilience. So you put those together, that's kind of how I just taught that at the top of the show here. So that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, I love it. I think there's a lot of great teachings across the world. If you look at like a lot of like religions and a lot of things, really what are they trying to do? They're trying to get people to just stick with some program and not vary from it. And it's kind of like it's not like a scalpel a lot of times. It's more like a butcher knife. Mm-hmm. But hey, at least these things, they give you some ethos and they create mechanisms where it's kind of painful to break from whatever the religion is.
Yeah, that's what we should do. That's what we do.
But yeah.
You know, like religion is heaven and hell. We should say, you know, you sell at the bottom, you're going to hell, buddy. Going to hell.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like weirdly, like religious, like it's funny to say, cause it's kind of like twisted irony here, but like, okay, you want to be evidence-based, like follow the data, like do the facts-based, science-based methodology, but then, okay, great. You come up with a strategy. Now you need to be faith-based and religion-based where you do not care what anyone says, any evidence. You're just, why do you believe in God? Because I have faith. Well, what about the science? What about the evidence? Doesn't matter. I have faith. Like it's weird. Once you get through the determine what religion you want to be in, then the next step is like, okay, now I got to transition to be faith, religious fervor on my strategy, because that a lot of times protect you from moving down the wrong path of, you know, changing it every 5 minutes.
But I think a lot of this is self-doubt, because I create a strategy. Let's say you and I, let's say Wes, you create a strategy. I create a strategy. Yep. We don't know. It's exactly the same. Exactly the same.
Yes.
I look at your strategy. I'm like, damn, that's a smart guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't know what it is. Yeah. But I'd follow you. My stuff is like, I created that. Who am I? You follow what I'm saying? That's what people do.
Yes. And one of the reasons our mission is to empower investors through education and not to like say Wes and his fancy PhD and make everyone think he's so smart is this is not about us. It's about the end investor, because if the end investor does not have endowment effect, full understanding, full education, full ownership of whatever process or idea, regardless of who says it, to your point, they don't, when things go bad, they'll bail. Mm-hmm. But if the end client actually internalizes and owns the knowledge more, maybe even more so than the person that, you know, invented the idea or the concept, their ability to be resilient in the firefight is much higher, because they have confidence. They've invested the time. They invested the effort. They understand why and how this works. Whereas if they don't do that, they have no confidence at the worst time. And they're like, all right, let's go try something else.
You're 100% right. We could probably agree that the most closely aligned to religion in the investment world, almost to a point of being zealot, is the crypto the gangs.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, never selling. Yeah. We're never selling. So why are you talking about it? Why are you spending all this time talking about it if you're never going to sell it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like also like the Warren Buffett followers, like I don't know if you've ever been out to the Berkshire meeting, like you could put like 10 holes in like the arguments of how they go about their lives. But the bottom line is most people that fall into that camp, because there's a nice religion, a nice process that's reasonable, and they stick to it no matter what, they usually do all right.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Like it doesn't even really matter what the process or what you're doing is. As long as you have a process and you stick to it, you know, you're probably going to do pretty good in the marketplace in the long
term. Yeah. And one of the things, you know, I had Daniel Crosby on 2 weeks ago too, and we talked about behavioral finance. This has a lot to do with it, right? The whole way not only do you think of it, but if you could understand how people do things, forget for a second the educational and trying to get everybody on board, because not everybody's going to get on board. But there is that part of it that could be very beneficial to understanding how markets work as well.
Yeah, for sure. So you got it.
Yep.
And some people, it's also like one of the big roles of advisors, like a lot of people talk trash about advisors. They're like, why would I pay 1%, you know, for Joe Blow to just go buy some Vanguard funds or, you know, whatever they're going to do. And there's a famous paper by Andre Seifert. It's called Money Doctors. And their kind of argument to try to like, you know, it's just a theoretical argument is, well, listen, if I'm an advisor and I charge 2%, but I cause the 30-year-old to allocate more to equities mm-hmm. and less cash under his pillow, I've literally moved to expect a return on his portfolio 4%. And yeah, I charged him 2%, but he's still better off because if I wasn't there to coach them and prod them to do something like take some risk, like do some actual investment ideas, they're going to end up worse off. And so it's just like this theoretical world where they're like, the reality is not everyone can be their own doctor. And most people left to their own devices in financial markets would be like, you know what? I'm going to put all my money under my pillow and just go buy an apartment down the street.
Well, there's two things.
That's not efficient.
Yeah. First of all, just to bring this up, my first radio show I ever did that I was the host of back in like 1990 mm-hmm. was the Money Doctor show. I was Andrew Horowitz, the Money Doctor. Yeah. And the second thing is I tell people, Wes, it's not that you can't or I can't manage my own money, but there's a reason why I don't cut my own hair. It's not that I can't take the scissor, functionally take a brush, pull some hair out and snip. But when it gets to the back, my perspective is all screwed up.
Yes.
Same thing with my own money. As an investor, your perspective is not square. You're not necessarily thinking straight about things. And the other side of your discussion, if you turn it upside down about getting higher expected return, is maybe keeping them in the markets when time they would have fled. I can't tell you how many people over the years, there have been times, you know, there's been times where you kind of, all right, let's lighten mm-hmm. up here. But there's other times like, it's not the time right now. Not that you're always right. You could be wrong. But I've had people like, oh, should we get out? I'm like, I don't think so. Then 4 years later, like, are you happy? You didn't get out. You didn't want to be in the market because X guy was elected president or congressman or there was a fire in California or whatever.
Yeah.
But you're there as a doctor, a counselor.
Yeah, I agree. To the extent that the advisor is in like a coach, counselor, leadership role, you know, trying to take care of him, do the right thing, it's the greatest thing people can do. It's the issue is the other side of it where they're acting like a doctor, but they're just a salesperson.
Yes.
You know, that's where you obviously get into the incentive problems. It's like, you know, if you go to the knee surgeon, hey, do I need knee surgery? Of course you do.
Yes. Fabulous. Both. Two.
Two of them. And you need a back while we're at it. Thanks, Cleveland Clinic. Yeah, appreciate that.
Right.
but yeah, so it, I feel like advisors get like, you know, a lot of bad baggage because
Some of them should.
And some of them should.
100%. I've seen stuff this year. I've seen stuff come across my desk for new clients. I'm like, what is happening here? Like, I don't get it.
Yes. 100%. There's a bunch of terrible ones, but the general concept of like, why do people pay for investment advice? It's, you know, cause there's all these arguments of like, why do you even do that? There's ETFs for everything. Why do you need Joe Blow, three piece suit? It's just, I think there is credible theories of why they're useful to people.
Yep.
Obviously.
Yep. Well, this has been awesome. And Dr. Gray, we're going to have all the information on how to get to Alpha Architects over on the Discipline Investor show notes, page 913 at thedisciplineinvestor.com. You can go to alphaarchitect.com as well and plenty of other places. Just look up Dr. Wesley Gray, G-R-A-Y, for more information. Good stuff, buddy.
Appreciate
and
you.
If you ever get out of your Puerto Rico hangout, you know, I'm here in Fort Lauderdale. I like Puerto Rico. I've been to a few of those hotels. Was it not the Coronado?
Sure.
Was that one on the cliffs there?
Yeah. There's a bunch of them. They got Fajardo, the Conquistador.
The Conquistador,
prize,
yes.
Conquistador. Yeah.
Where they were spraying me with Evian. I'm like, wow, this is a cool place.
Yeah, they got the private island out there.
Yeah. You take the funicular down slide. And you go to the island. Yep. Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Good it's stuff. Actually back up and running. Hurricane Maria destroyed that thing, but they just reopened it 2 or 3 years ago, and it's back in business and great as ever.
I think I've told you this before, but one of my favorite things was driving down that road to the Conquistador from San Juan, and there's a long stretch of road, and there is, I can't even, thousands of guys that will fix your car, any part of your car. You know what I'm talking about, that road?
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Ferreterias, Yeah, that's like a big thing down here. I have the same question. Why are there so many like hardware stores and tire stores?
Tires, yes.
Like, how do these guys in business? There's like 100 varieties in like a 2 mile stretch.
Right.
It's crazy. I still don't understand why that exists, but yep. Hey, it's interesting phenomenon. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon, Wes. Thanks.
You got it.
Fantastic. That was awesome. That was awesome. I told you in the beginning I was pumped to have this discussion today. Wes is a really smart guy. I love that. Wow, that was great. Anyway, thanks for joining me this week and every week. Next week, we have some great guests, a great guest coming on as well. We have David Gaffin coming up, Tim Knight, then Manuel Bly, and Brian Dress. So it just keeps on going. Good stuff happening. Thanks for joining me this show. Thanks for joining me every week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as DH Unplugged. I'll see you again, real soon. Thanks. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.